So this is a joint work with Wissam Chemisani, who is a recent moved as a postdoc to Hanover. I want to start with a disclaimer, a word of warning. This is going to be very introductory. So I've just started some of the last couple of months learning about this stuff. So there won't be very much new, but I want this to serve as a sort of introduction to this subject to people who come at it from the angle maybe of tensor network, which is also where I come from. So I want to start with explaining roughly how one can think of a tensor network as a sort of discrete version of path integrals. Or rather, path integral as a continuous version of tensor networks in the sense that the path integrals is more rarely well-defined than the tensor networks. So here's an example of a tensor network. So think of each box as a tensor, each leg as an index. And when two legs match, it means the corresponding index are contracted. And the open lengths are indices which are not contracted, which are open. And therefore, the open lengths tell you what kind of tensor this represents. So I want to think of this as being embedded in some manifold M. If I do this, and if I cut a piece of the manifold out, then I'm making new open legs, and so this is a new tensor. And this works in such a way that if I now assign an index to each leg, think of the index as element of a basis in each vector space has to do with the legs, then the tensor networks assign a number to this particular region of space-time. So the tensor networks assign numbers to region of space-time, provided that we assign indices on the boundary. And this works pretty much in the same way as a path integral. So if I have an action on that manifold, then I can do path integral, which means that, at least in principle, that if I select a submanifold or a region of the space, then if I cut it out and if I set a value that the field should take on the boundary, then the path integral inside the bulk of this region will also assign a complex number to it. So this is to be compared to that. So the idea is that one should think of these indices on the boundary as sort of a discrete specification of a field on the boundary, a field of indices. So if I can take again an action on this manifold, in fact, one can starting from this, one can try to derive a tensor network that gives a discretization of that manifold. One way to do this is to, yeah.
Is this action dependent also on the derivatives of the field?
Yeah, sorry.
Is that a simplification?
Yeah.
Okay,
very good.
Just symbolic.
Yeah. Also, one may, you know, depending whether, I'm not specifying whether it's time or not, you know, one might need to specify boundary conditions for this to be well-defined. I'm just assuming that one knows how to do the path integral in that context. I'm being very schematic on purpose. So one could divide this space into pieces. And by doing the path integral on each piece, one obtains a tensor where the legs correspond to the vector space of possible boundary value of the field along the corresponding boundary region. Of course, these are now infinite dimensional, but the point is that if we now contract back all these legs, we are redoing the whole path integral and the whole manifold. So this is sort of an exact discretization. And the next step, one may think of making those Hilbert space finite dimensional in some way, in some approximation to obtain a real tensor network that will approximate the space. If one think of the correspondence between space and the tensor network in this way, one can so imagine in what sense the connectivity of the tensor networks reproduces or encodes some property of the geometry of the space. For instance, if you assume that, you know, if each tensor has the same components, if they're all the same tensors, and they've been obtained in this way, then it means that the corresponding pieces of space have to have the same, have to be identical, have to be the same metric on them. And so since there are so many ways to tessellate a manifold, it tells you a little bit about what the geometry of the manifold might have been. So if you see a network like this, and if each tensor is identical, then you might think that this has to do with a flat two-dimensional space. And if you see one like this, you may think it has to do with hyperbolic space, which I will define in a few moments. Now, the path integral is just one way of defining a filter in a manifold. There are many other ways. But what they all have in common, or what I would like them to have in common, and this is only what I will use about filtering in this talk, is that if I, again, take any kind of region of the space, then the filter assigns to that region a vector space to each boundary, and to the bulk, it assigns an element of the tensor product of the corresponding vector spaces. So I say vector space because they may not be Hilbert spaces, depending on the context. These cuts might be time-like or space-like, or so. So when one does it this way, one has to be careful with the orientation of these boundaries. One may want to assign the dual of vector space or the vector space itself, depending on the orientation of the boundary. In such a way that if we have the missing piece, which has the composite orientations, we can use the natural pairing of vector space and its dual in order to paste it together so that we get a correspondence between gluing manifold together and multiplying or pairing according to linear or tensors. If you're not comfortable about thinking of filter in this way, you can always interpret everything I say, assuming that I'm really talking about tensor networks without specifying the exact geometry of the tensor network. And this pairing amounts to simply pairing legs, so contracting legs. And the orientation has to do with the fact that if the legs represent vector spaces, they have to have an orientation. And I'm allowed to contract them only if they have the corresponding orientation. So I want to say one word about holography, which is a motivation for ADS CFT in very, very simple terms. So as a kind of simple game, if one is given a quantum state of many qubits, so here I just represent it as a tensor with many legs, each leg for each qubit, one might ask the interesting question of whether this can be reproduced by a tensor network. It's a good question to ask, because if that's the case, then not only this tells a lot about the entanglement structure of the state, but it also allows us to encode the state with exponentially fewer parameters. Also, if one imagines that we somehow have a unique way of doing this by serving some kind of optimization process, so asking something like, you know, what's the minimal? So of course there are many ways to represent the same states using different tensor networks, but one might try to ask, you know, what is the minimum number of tensors and the lowest dimensions of the bounds. And this one could imagine a context where this gives us a unique tensor network, more or less. And if this happens, then one can think of this. And if one also thinks of these tensor networks as representing some kind of space-time or space, then one has a sort of emergent space just from the state itself. This is also what happens with, you know, one can think of Mera, where starting from a one-dimensional or higher-dimensional lattice state, one tries to find a tensor network of this form that reproduces it. So in this case, these tensors are unitary, or isometry, and so there's a causality and a natural time direction. So one could think of this as an emergent, not only space, but space-time. So before I explain what anti-de Sitter is, let me explain what Haverly space and de Sitter spaces are. This will allow us not only to warm up, but also to understand better the structure of ADS space. So the easiest way to represent it is to start with a flat Minkowski space with one dimension of time, and here in the dimension of space. So this has a group of isometries, so a diffeomorphism that leaves a metric invariant, the flat metric invariant. This is a Poincaré group, but here I will focus only on those homogeneous transformations, namely a linear subgroup, which is a group of Lorentz transformations and rotations, the Lorentz group. So it has rotation in space and a rotation that exchange time and space, which are boosts. They are rotations with an imaginary angle. One way to understand this, this group is to think about the submanifold of surfaces which are left invariant by the action of the group. So a typical example is a double light cone, which is invariant under SO1D. But there are many other surfaces which are invariant. There are space-like surfaces inside the future in the path of the light cone, which are hyperboloids. And these, as being embedded in this flat space with a flat metric, they inherit a metric from the embedding, which is precisely the hyperbolic metric. So these surfaces are two copies of the hyperbolic plane. There are other invariant surfaces outside the light cone which have a time direction. And they also inherit a metric, and those are this is the Sitter space. So this picture is nice because it tells us if one has some intuition on how SO1D acts, the Lorentz group acts in this flat space-time, one immediately sees how it acts also on these invariant surfaces. And in fact, this group SO1D is the complete group of isometries of both hyperbolic space and the Sitter space in one lower dimension. Now I want to talk about the, somehow the boundary at infinity where those two surfaces asymptotically meet along the light cone. And to be able to talk about it more nicely, one typically will want to compactify it. You look at the coordinate systems where it's brought back to a finite to within the screen. And so this can be done in this way, schematically. So really, you know, this circle should be thought of as reliving at infinity in the future. In higher dimension, this circle is a sphere. And there's also, since the group SO1D acts within hyperbolic space and Sitter space, it also leaves this boundary at infinity invariant, so it also acts on this boundary at infinity. And it turns out that the way it acts on it is as a group of conformal transformation of the sphere. So here by sphere, I mean the sphere with its normal metric, and the conformal transformations are diffeomorphisms which do not preserve the metric, but preserve the angle. So one aspect of the metric. The sphere, conformally the sphere is almost the same as the plane. So there's a transformations from the plane to the sphere, which is conformal, which is an example is a stereographic projection. So one can think of this sphere as a plane, a flat plane, where the group SO1D of isometries of the two space acts on it as a group of conformal transformations. So this is a the geometric and symmetric correspondence between hyperbolic space, the Sitter space, and conformal geometry. So I want to give some intuition on how the group acts on these structures. So the rotations in space are clear. They're just the whole picture rotates around the time axis. For boosts, one has to choose a direction, a space-like direction in which to boost. And to give a notion of what this does, I want to draw two lines, one in the space and one in the space. These are geodesics. So once they are boosted, they will still be geodesics. So what the boost does is it maps this to something like that. So the middle line is mapped to a circle, which is still orthogonal to the boundary. If I boost in the other direction, it goes like this. So we see that what the boost does is it somehow takes all the points in the hyperbolic space and kind of expand and gather them toward this point. And it does this in the opposite way on the opposite hyperbolic space. So now that we are warmed up, I can introduce anti-de Sitter space. So it's done by going to one more dimension of time. So now it's like Minkowski space, but with two times. So it's just a flat metric with two negative sign and the positive sign in the signature. And this is invariant under the group SO2D of linear transformations. So this is essentially the same as a group of Lorentz transformations, except that there are more types of boosts because there are more ways of mixing times and space. So one invariant surface in there which is of interest is a hyperboloid that is on the side. And the metric this inherit is anti-de Sitter metric. So this is anti-de Sitter space. Even though it lives in a space with two time direction, because it's one lower dimension, it has only one time direction, so it is a normal space-time, except that it has time-like loops. But this can be removed easily by just neglecting to identify the angles. So this can be unwrapped to avoid any time-like loops. So here I've drawn this. These boundaries don't really exist. Of course, it's infinite in both directions. But I want to compactify it again to make a nice representation. So one can take those points at infinity and bring them back. And what one typically does is to cut it open here and fold it into a rectangle. And since now I removed the embedding dimension, I can add one more dimension to show more structure. To do this, one way to do it is to realize that two points on both sides of the time axis correspond to a zero-dimensional circle or sphere. And so in one more dimension, this becomes a circle, and this is what this looks like. So AD space now in 2 plus 1 dimension is a cylinder. So remember that on the original ADS, these two sections are space-like sections are identified. And the boundary of the cylinder corresponds to the points at infinity. So I want to give intuition on the geometry of one space-like slice, a time slice. So the time slices in these coordinate systems are hyperbolic space. So that's a nice intuitive way of thinking of hyperbolic space, a famous drawing by Escher. So in the geometry hyperbolic geometry, each of these angels or demons have the exact same shape and size. So it looks like this in a section of ADS, and all the sections have the same geometry. In fact, this coordinate system is static, so the components of the metric don't depend on time. In order to get a little bit more intuition, it is about the geometry of that space. It is nice to understand the structure of the time-like geodesics, which are the trajectories of dust particles in the space. So one geodesic is simply this central line by symmetry. And all the other geodesics can be obtained by applying the element of the group of symmetry SO2D to this line. So for instance, if you do a boost, we obtain something like this. And if we boost in the other direction, we obtain something like that. And so we immediately see that if we send two particles in opposite direction at this point, they will meet again in finite time. So it shows that the space is contracting. Another nice set of geodesics to think about are the time-like, light-like geodesics. So the rays of light, they go from minus infinity to plus infinity in a finite time, the exact same time that it takes for the two particles to meet again. And in fact, there are many light-like geodesics which intersect the boundary at those two points. And there are a whole family of them which wrap around a certain surface inside ADS space, which is actually dust-sitter space. So I already said that the space-like sections are hyperbolic, but they're also time-like sections, which are dust-sitter. So the structures I've drawn here are actually invariant under a subgroup SO1D of the full symmetry group SO2D. So there are two copies of the sitter space and two copies of hyperbolic space, which are invariant. And so one can immediately see from the previous discussion that this subgroup acts as a conformal group on this space-like section of the boundary. Now, it turns out that the whole group SO2D acts as a bigger group of conformal transformation of space-time, of flat space-time on the whole boundary. To see how it does that, one has to understand how flat Minkowski space is embedded, or is compactified and wrapped around this boundary. So let me explain how this works. So this is Minkowski space. And I've drawn some light-like directions to help the eye. And this can be compactified in this way. Then this patch can be pasted on the ADS cone, cylinder, and then wrapped around. And this is how it fits. So we see that this Minkowski patch does not span the whole boundary, but only half of it. The other half can be covered by the same one more copy of this one. Remember that those two surfaces are identified. So this is the top behind. This is the top half and the bottom half of a second copy of a flat patch. And these boundaries that are common have to be identified between the two patches. And so the group of conformal symmetries is allowed to freely move between those two patches. So to go back to tensor networks, Brian Schwingel has argued that a mirror should be thought of as a discretization of a spatial slice of antidensity, which is just hyperbolic space, with the output of mirror on this boundary at infinity. This is somewhat compatible with an idea in the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is that the bulk should be thought of, well, if there is a conformal filtery on the boundary, that is a quantum filtery which is symmetric under all the conformal transformation, then one should think of the bulk, the degrees of freedom, as corresponding to coarse graining of the boundary. So if one cut a cylinder slightly inside this big cylinder, then the filtery on that cylinder should be thought of as a coarse graining of the CFT on the boundary, and that's kind of intuitively compatible with putting mirror in there. However, this is not entirely satisfactory because this is completely ignoring the causal structure in mirror, which indicate that it rather has a time direction. So one could also think of putting mirror, why not, on the sitter surface inside ADS, which gives it a time direction, or rather on half of the sitter space. This is also possibly compatible with the idea that inside the bulk, going inside the bulk has to do with coarse graining, the theory on the boundary. And so Mera in that sense could be interpreted as starting from a coarse grain version of the filtery and fine graining it going in the real time direction of antidensity. Just a possibility. So now I want to somehow paraphrase a recent paper by a mathematician, Albert Schwarz, which gives sort of a nice axiomatic way of starting from a quantum filtery inside ADS space and from it deriving a conformal filtery on the boundary of ADS space. So I don't know to what extent this is compatible with what people think of as ADS CFT in string theory, but it's nonetheless a nice starting point to start learning about the correspondence and learning about conformal filtery. So I will try to explain how this works. Before I do that, I want to mention that this is not done in ADS itself, but in hyperbolic space, which one might thought of as obtained from ADS by weak rotation, replacing time by imaginary time, which we think of as an inverse temperature. So when one does this, then the metric of ADS becomes a hyperbolic metric, because the times of the of time changes and becomes Euclidean instead of Lorentzian. So this is kind of the framework in which it's done. So this is essentially talking about the vacuum state. It's talking about Euclidean path integral instead of a real-time path integral. So I'm not going to take ADS. I'm just going to take hyperbolic space and remove this boundary at infinity, which is not really a boundary because it's at infinity. And now when I put a real boundary in by cutting a piece out of this hyperbolic space, then if there's a filtery inside the space, what it does is it associates this boundary with a vector space, which I will take here as a dual of some vector space V. And the bulk corresponds to an element of V star. So here I'm drawing things in two dimensions, but really this could be done in any number of dimensions. So for example, in one higher dimension, this corresponds to cutting a little part of a sphere outside of the big ball in the same way as this. So whenever I draw those pictures, you know, imagine kind of the higher dimension thing. There's a natural extension. Another thing to say is that I'm assuming that the filter inside ADS has all the same symmetries as the metric of ADS itself, as well as the boundary conditions, if those are needed. Which means that if I apply any of the SO1D group elements to this space, like a rotations or a boost, then these cuts, because these cuts are rotated by symmetry, they all correspond to the same vector space V star. Moreover, the corresponding bulk correspond to the same element of V star as well. So these are all represent the same object. And we see that the kind of cut I've been using is just image under a symmetry of cutting the ball in half. And all the cuts I will use are the same, just obtained by symmetry from this half cut. So this object is special, so I will color it in green. I will reuse it later. So the basic object that I'm interested in are of this form. So they correspond to taking n holes out of the ball, the hyperbolic ball. So for example, if I take three holes, then this gives me an element of three copies of this vector space. So how do I think of this physically? So the suppose I normalize the size of those balls to a fixed value, which is small enough that they don't intersect, then I can simply label the balls by the location on the boundary. So x, 1, 2, 3 are some location in a coordinate system that I used on the boundary. Moreover, if I choose element of the corresponding vector spaces, vector space is only one of them in that case, then I contract them with this three-leg tensor that is this bulk, then I get a number. So if I think of, if I call this fi the composition of the concatenation of this vector space element together with the location of the hole in which they are put, I want to think of those as mirroring functions or test functions in such a way that this complex number should be thought of as an endpoint function for fields living on the boundaries mirrored according to these smearing functions. So this seems like a very big step, unjustified. I haven't defined what these operators are. I have not defined the Hilbert space nor the product. But this should be taken in the spirit of the Whiteman axiom for quantum field theory, where one starts from an endpoint functional which takes n, which is a multilinear map on n test functions. But this is a physical interpretation. And once, if these endpoint functionals have the right properties, some positivity properties, then there are ways mathematically to build from it a Hilbert space representation that will look something like this. So because these fields are smeared in terms of fields which are located on the boundary, then one think of this as a theory living on the boundary.
What so, did you say these were V1, V2?
The element of the vector space associated with these cuts. So we have
a field. F is a pair which is a vector space and a point on the boundary.
Yes, sir. Yeah, so.
Oh, it's elements of those.
Yeah, so.
How is that the same as a smearing function?
No, it's not the same. I'm trying to think of it as maybe a precursor of what the function would be. So it's not very clear at this point whether it's just enough or whether one has to take some kind of limits with some coarse grading for this to work. I'm not quite sure, but at this point I want to think of it in this way. So
I want a way to nicely compute this type of endpoint function. So I'm going to do this by building tensors, certain particular tensor from the bulk theory. So one particular tensor of interest is this one. So it's almost like a two-point function. This cut is just the same as normal cuts, but I've just boosted it further than usual. However, I choose a different orientation for one of the boundary, so that is correspond to the dual vector space. So this is a tensor, which is an element of V, tensor V star. So it's actually a linear map from V to V. And it turns out that it depends on just one real parameter, which is the ratio of the concentric spherical cuts. So it's a linear map on V. And I can, in this way, I can naturally compose it with itself, which corresponds to pasting pieces of the space in this way. And so this gives me a semigroup, a one-parameter semigroup, which I can use to, if I have an endpoint function with a certain hole of a given size, I can use it to change the size of the holes to make them smaller by just multiplying by this element of V, this linear map on V. So I want to think of this as sort of a local scaling operator. There's another operator of interest, which is this one. So it's just like a three-point function, but a special one. And again, I've chosen different notation for two of the boundary cuts. So by multiplying this one together with the scaling operator on some of the whole of endpoint function, I can transform an endpoint function into an plus n minus one point function, or I can use a dual to transform an endpoint function into n plus one point functions. So by using these three special colored tensors that I introduced, I can take any endpoint functions and cut it as a multiplication of
a composition of these particular tensors. If you look at the structure of this contraction of these tensors, you see that it is actually a tree tensor network. So I can build any of the endpoint functions as a particular tree tensor network. So these are the basic objects I used, and might want to think of this as defining the operator product expansion of a CFT. So of course one can then use the symmetries to further study the the particular algebraic properties of these tensors, but I will not do this at this point. This is more of an invitation. What I want to do now is to discuss how one one possibility that one could try to do this not in imaginary time but in real time. So back to ADS. So imagine now that everything I've done actually to a space-like cut of ADS. So all of the holes were obtained by cutting half of the hyperbolic ball away. So I want to extend this cut somehow in the bulk in such a way that, at least geometrically, all of the cutting and pasting that I did before still work. So there are many ways one could try to do this, to extend it in this way, for instance. However, if I ask Mathematica what this is under a boost, we see that if I try to make this thing very small on this spatial slice, it becomes very large on a different spatial slice. So there's no way that I can take this off of the big cylinder without them intersecting. So I cannot play this game with this type of cut. So let's try a different one. One can try to find to take a causal wedge extension. These are nice. If I boost them, they become small and they don't intersect. However, the thing that differs, so I don't know how much of a problem that is, but the thing that differs from the previous picture is that if I look at the complement is not obtained by is not identical under symmetry as the original space. So this aspect of the game does not work. There is, however, one possibility that function, which is this one. So this is kind of a staircase or a spiral. So this one divides the space into two parts, just like it does on a space-like boundary. It has this thing with a time-like direction. And when I boost, when I apply a boost to it, it becomes small pretty much everywhere, in such a way that if I take several of them, they don't intersect. At least if they don't intersect on this space-like cut, they don't intersect either inside the bulk. However, I can only apply the SO1D subgroup of the SO2D subgroup for this to work. They do touch at two points, one point here in the bulk and one here in the bulk. So one sees that, if I take them off, for instance, of the as of the full cylinder, so this corresponds to, I want to call those grooves, so they correspond to two grooves taken off. So this will be one of the scaling operators I had before. So we see that, so here in this picture, the dimension of the boundary is 1 plus 1 dimension, but this will work. This can work in any dimension. Now 1 plus 1 dimension is a bit too small in the sense that here, so this groove, if I make them very small, they correspond to a light-like directions going around the boundary. And in a 1 plus 1 dimensional space, the light can only go in two directions. And here they all have to go in the same directions in order not to intersect. But in a higher dimensional space, these grooves can go in any light-like direction. What this means is that instead of building the endpoint functions by element of those vector space labeled by pure location in space, now I have to add a label, which is the direction in space in which the groove runs. So one might think of those as sort of helicities. And then it will just work the same way. So if I imagine putting Mera in this Dacita slice, I might ask what the scaling operator looks like. So this groove will cut through Mera as well. And so the scaling operator will correspond to a scaling operator on this Dacita slice. And I just want to show what it looks like to give an intuition. So here's Mera drawn in a slightly smarter way. And so this will be the scaling operator. So the red part. In higher dimension, this corresponds to two concentric cylinders, to the space between two concentric cylinders. So this is very different from other proposals of what the scaling operator will be in Mera. So I don't have much more to say about it at this point. I just leave it there. Well, so
where is it acting? What is it transforming?
So it is acting on any tensors you would plug in here. So these are open legs.
Oh,
so plug a tensor here, and then apply it, and you get a tensor on this larger groove. To say sometimes, we just want to mention the black holes. So this is a black hole in ADS space. So what does it mean to put a black hole in ADS? It means that there's a black hole that might look like a Schwarzschild black hole in the bulk, and then in one go far away, asymptotically, we recover ADS space. But in the case of 2 plus 1 dimensional ADS, this is particularly simple because the Einstein equation says that the space has to have the same curvature at every point, so it looks everywhere like ADS space. So the only way one can get a black hole is by cutting pieces out of space, of ADS space, and pasting it together. So in this case, if I go back to the picture with the two grooves, which was a scaling operator, the Betelgeuse black hole is obtained by, so this works only in 2 plus 1 dimension. The Betelgeuse black hole is given by identifying those two grooves. So one groove is the image of the other under a boost, and so each point in one of the grooves corresponds to a point in the other groove under the boost. And so one can just identify those two points, and this is a Betelgeuse black hole. Actually, it's 2 copies of a black hole plus time-like loops. So technically, one should remove the time-like loops, which are here, which come from the fact that the boost in the pastes are removed is time-like, and therefore, once we identify two directions in time-like directions, one gives time-like loops. So if I add back the groove, this looks like this. So this is actually 2 copies of the black hole, so one here and 2 half here. So one could try to play this game again on this space. I don't have much more to say about it at this point, but at least it makes a nice picture. And I will stop here. Thank you for your attention.
Any other questions?
So can you summarize the proof by Schwarz? What is the statement that you're making?
So there are many things I don't quite understand. And the way I presented it is a little bit different from the way he presented it, because there are some aspects of his presentation that I don't quite understand. So this is my attempt at understanding what he's actually doing. Well, I don't know what to say more, because I don't understand more than what I've said. Do you have a specific question? Yeah, so he starts from a quantum theory in the bulk of ADS, and then derives a set of endpoint functionals, which can be built out of this algebraic structure that is only defined by those 3-point functions and scaling operators. And in some sense, this lives on the boundary because the locations of the endpoint of the endpoint functions of the smearing fields are on the boundary.
I guess it's the same question, but can you say a little more concretely what's the connection? He starts with a quantum field theory in the bulk, and he gets something, endpoint functions of some form.
Yes.
How do you go from the one to the other?
So the way I go from one to the other is to use the quantum field theory on the bulk to build this set of tensors. Well, okay, so if you forget about those particular tensors, This is essentially the way that one gets from one to the other. That is, one. So, you do you agree that the filter in the bulk ought to give to assign a vector space to those cuts, and ought to you know, if you do the path integral inside the bulk, it will give an element of the tensor product of those three vector spaces, or more than.
Boundary conditions for doing the path integral? Does a V represent a kind of boundary condition for doing the bulk path integral?
Yeah, exactly. So,
What is the boundary condition?
So the boundary conditions are defined by this element V1, V2, or V3. So think of the vector space V as the linear space of classical field value, a linear space of which a basis is a set of classical field value on one of the boundary. And then V3, therefore, is just linear combinations of possible classical field value on that boundary.
And is it, the bulk theory could be a scalar theory field, or it could be, what kind of fields?
So, this is very abstract. And one could do this is, in principle, any field theory, provided that, you know, that it does, you know, properly assign a vector space to the boundary and that it properly give a corresponding tensors when integrated. So, you know, because the path integral itself is not very well defined, this one has to define the theory in some way that this type of structure and contraction is well defined.
So, are there any concrete examples? Gauge theory, I don't know, scalar.
So, this should work with path theory. So, I haven't had the time to try it and see what happens exactly, but of course, this is something to do.
But in that paper, there's no
concrete. No, it has things like that. But this is done in kind of the same type of philosophy as the way that one defines a TQFT. Right? And that's kind of the background that where he comes from. In fact, he defined the CFT in this way, inspired by a paper by Segal, which defines CFT in a similar way, but without talking about the bulk, just talking about the boundary and holes into the boundary. But he does so for 1+1 CFT, which has much more symmetries. Whereas this, in principle, should work in any dimension.
And can we see why it's a conformal theory on the boundary? It must trace to the symmetry somehow, but...
Yeah, so one other thing is that... One is the action of the symmetries, which also act on those points, but then, you know, so there's a bit more in the paper, which is analyzing this operator, for instance. You see that, you know, you can start defining... this is a semi-group, so you can start defining... eigenvectors of this linear operator, and you might want to call these scaling fields, or, you know. And so when you do this and you start computing this endpoint function, you see that, you know, you get the same type of properties of the correlator as you would expect from a CFT. And you see that by using this, you can get the OPEs, so everything, you know, kind of works out. I didn't check all of the CFT axioms because I'm kind of new to this, but. I want to go further and understand this better.
Any more questions?
No, let's thank Cedric again.